It's a real luxury to be able to speak in English, and so I'll try and speak slowly. I hope you can understand my accent, and I'll try and pronounce Abrahamic, Hagaramic. Clearly, I've put up some of the citations and some suggestive images to distract you or to give you something else to think about as I'm talking. I know that it's been a long day, and I shall try hard to stick to time. Okay, so the Abrahamic, Hagaramic, or Abraham, the non-European. It won't just be a Bible study, don't worry. I want to open up the question of religion and representation by looking at the shifting constellations of concepts and values that make up those notional spaces, Europe and the West. If you're looking for it, I believe you need to look somewhere between Europe and North America in the North Atlantic, to find that vague hemisphere of amalgamation and alliance that we call the West. The European and the Western have been projected as forms of union, cultural, political, economic, and religious. They are mental cartographies, topographies of alliance that change as the key ideas and the arrangements and alliances between those key ideas change. The West has a temporal cognate, we call it modernity, which we imagine as a kind of endpoint or end game in time. Modernity and the century or epoch function as homelands, like the nation state. And indeed, the habit of batching time in centuries or periods like the Renaissance and talking of modernity from modus now came about at the same time as the rise of the nation state. Modernity is related to Westernness, and both are defined in perhaps the most stable and regular definition of all for these profoundly volatile entities by a fundamental shift in the relation between religion and the state. One vague constant is that the Euro-American, the Western, relates in some fundamental way to the Christian. The relation to the Christian is a sure foundation, but the archives and meanings of Christianity are pliable, and the way that we've mapped our relation to the Christian archive has profoundly changed. A constant has been the border with Asia, or more specifically, the kind of East that is not far, but near. The sons of Shem, as opposed to Europeans as the sons of Japhet, or the Turks and Moors of the Ottoman Empire. From the vantage point of a secularized Europe that shows its secular credentials by calling itself Europe, not Christendom, we over-exaggerate how far Christianity dominated Europe once upon a unified time. The, quote, resplendent times when Europe was a Christian land, when one Christendom occupied this humanly constituted continent, to quote Novalis, was easier to imagine in 1799 than in the resplendent time he nostalgically conjures. As Guy Strumster writes, citizens of the old times of Christendom never forgot that the religious identity of Europe was manifold and always pointed eastward. The Muslim Turks were at the gates of Vienna, and the roots of Christianity were known to lie in Palestinian Judaism. In other words, it was only later that the Christian identity of Europe would become a source of narcissistic self-satisfaction. A self-satisfaction now sometimes broadened to include its Judeo-Christian or even Abrahamic roots. And I'm going to say a little bit more about this late modern word identity and also this very recent expansion to the Judeo-Christian and the Abrahamic in a few minutes. At some point, the point we tend to call modernity, the fundamental relation between Christianity and Europe and the Western changed. In fact, it went through a complete reversal, though no one really noticed, because everyone carried on speaking of the same old alliance between Christianity and the West and the same general shared aims. The turn to democracy and secularization that made us Western and modern was enacted in a very particular way. In general, such moves were described not as a revolt against the Christian God, but what the true Christian God had always wanted, though it had taken us a while to realise this. Christianity and its gods were fundamentally kenotic. They wanted to sacrifice themselves. They were opposed to the divine right of kings. They did not want to intervene in politics and law directly, unlike more oppressive scriptures and theocratic deities we could mention. This meant that our politics and our legal languages could be separated from the language of scripture. We no longer had to reference biblical precedents in meticulous detail, or put our politics in overtly, as opposed to covertly or structurally theological terms. In this sense, Locke displaced Habakkuk, as Karl Marx said. But what Marx forgets is how much Locke and his cohort said that this was exactly what the Bible wanted. Yes, the Bible and Christianity took on a retired emeritus status as the past of Europe, but they stayed on as a venerable and crucial foundation because, so the logic goes, only Christianity had the good grace and expansiveness to allow the gods to die, or at least sit back from politics. This meant that we were free from the Christian base, but also free in the Christian base, because we were indebted to the unique self-givingness of the Christian base, which we could dispense with at our peril, because only Christianity modelled a type of religion capable of being entirely free. Only Christianity facilitated what de Tocqueville lauded as the unique marriage of two distinct elements, the spirit of religion and the spirit of liberty, which in other places have been in frequent disagreement. The material content of religion, the mess of text, evaporates and becomes spirit. The spirit of religion is geistic, spiritual, abstract, intellectual, not fundamentalist, not literalist, but nebulous and malleable and free. In his Democracy in America from the 1840s, de Tocqueville cites Nathaniel Morton, a historian of the first years of the settlement, who writes, "We may not hide from our children, showing to the generations to come the praises of the Lord, that especially the seed of Abraham, his servant, and the children of Jacob, his chosen, may remember his marvellous works in the beginning." The homegrown miracle is that the seed of Abraham, a specifically biblical seed, had generated, or at the very least made a covenant with, fundamental principles of modern constitutions, such as the intervention of people in public affairs, the free voting of taxes, the responsibility of the agents of power, personal liberty, and trial by jury. Abraham foresaw all of this. Indeed, the Bible bequeaths to us the whole idea of covenant and contract between God and man in the moral law and the politic covenants and constitutions among men themselves. And as the acknowledged father of liberalism, John Locke, elaborates, promises, covenants, and oaths, which are the bonds of humane society, by definition cannot bind the atheist, nor do they apply to the Catholics and Mahometans, since they deliver themselves up to the protection and service of another prince. The internal relation with Christianity has entirely changed, but what is stable is the use of the Turk, Moors, the sons of Shem, or the Ottoman Empire as point of contrast. For early moderns, Catholics, Turks, and Moors are the off-sited other of freedom as theocracies and despotisms, human and divine. We need to understand the unique relationship between Christianity and freedom in our origin stories to understand the strangely parsimonious distribution of freedom and freedom of religion, which is, of course, a primary hallmark of the West. The earliest gestures towards religious pluralism made space for freedom in Christianity. They made space for non-conformist Christianity, without loosening the reference back to the one religion that made one truly free. We can only understand the belated and uneven emancipation for the atheist, Jew, and Catholic if we understand to what we owe this debt to freedom. Because we owe this debt to a particular place, Freedom can only be cautiously free. If it is not very carefully free, it will lose its connection to the free. Of course, freedom is the key concept for Europe, America, and Westernness. A key criterion for membership is the demonstration of freedom. But the way you demonstrate freedom and the precise connotations of freedom change, and freedom is difficult to see. What is useful about the vacuous, open concept of freedom is that it is, well, free. How do you see freedom, recognize freedom? Who are the ones who are appointed to register or not the presence of freedom? Who are these godlike examiners or observers, and what precisely do they watch for? Freedom of religion, like free elections, is used as one of the key proofs of freedom. The proof of a mature Western polity is that religion is voluntary and that it can host more than one religion on ostensibly equal terms. We demonstrate plurality of religion by pointing to the flourishing of multiple religious identities in public and hosting a range of public religious representatives, an interesting term. Protestants, Catholics, Jews, Muslims, Sikhs, Hindus, Buddhists, etc. We set the table where archbishops, rabbis, and imams can get together, and these days we must never forget to include an imam. This term, religious representatives, is revealing. Recently, we've witnessed a key shift in our understanding of religion and representation, organized around that distinctly modern term, identity. Among the various meanings of identity are a set of behavioral or personal characteristics by which an individual is recognizable, a persisting entity, and the quality or condition of being the same as something else. Identity is deep, inviolable, consistent, persistent, and individual, but not alone. Identity is a collective noun, a noun of the more than one. For an identity to count, it must be the same as something else. Identity is ritualized and recognizable. It's a public identity, not a concealed one. Identity is collective individuality based on learned and recognizable behavior. We can see it in a particular set of clothes, a particular way of interpreting a sacred text. The notion of identities is a great way of organizing religion and what counts as religion. It allows for multiple identities that demonstrate difference, but at the same time, it restricts difference. Built into the very idea of identity are regulatory frameworks that make membership of the category of religion subject to conditions as stringent as membership of the EU. To qualify, religious identities must be religious as opposed to, say, political. They must be able to demonstrate persistence. But how long does an identity have to have persisted or existed to count? The very idea of identity allows us to regulate religious characteristics and behaviours. If identity is the quality or condition of being the same as something else, then who gets to say what counts as the core of sameness and conformity? The religious identities that get to count are those that have established mechanisms of self-representation and public visibility. Those which are already acknowledged members of the major world or world league religions, we could say the Premier League religions. Those that demonstrate persistence, antiquity, ancient pedigree, dusty old scriptures. Those that have enough members to count as a collective individuality worth counting, which is to say those who band together in religious collectives or religious firms, and those that can demonstrate compatibility with the ideals of the democratic state. There's great potential here, legally and otherwise, for disqualifying certain identities and practices. Slavoj Žižek is right, I think, to see the discomfort with the veil in Europe as a reaction against, quote, an erective exposure a too strong to be permissible sign of one's identity. Admissible identities are identities light, those that have a face to count, that come out into the open, that represent themselves in the correct forms of public manifestation, not secretion, and that speak in tongues that we can understand. Okay, I want to look at how the idea of Christian roots has been very carefully and strategically pluralized in relation to changes in the meanings of Europe. And in particular, I want to look at the invention of these recent terms, the Judeo-Christian and the Abrahamic. If the identity of Europe has never been as stable as we sometimes imagine, recently it has undergone some very public identity crises, a term first used in 1954. One identity crisis is related to the rising notion of identity, completing identities, and immigration. In one possible etymology, Europe comes from Eurus, wide, broad, and ops, meaning eye, face, or countenance, hence Europe, wide gazing, broad of aspect. These days, imagining that multiculturalism and multi-religionism is a new problem for Europe, which is and is not true, Europe makes a controversial virtue of accommodating a wider range of faces, a larger spectrum of identities, and broadening out to embrace a far greater range of sexual, ethnic, and religious difference, while also managing and regulating difference through conceptual and actual border control. This hospitality to the other, this virtue of alterity, is directly related to the histories of Shoah and empire, which turned provincial Europe into a term of accusation, and also the place where we perform public rites of repentance in our laws and constitutions. Bound up with the same World War was the foundation of the State of Israel as an annex of Europe, gifted by the British, with a founding elite of Ashkenazim, white European Jews. From that same World War and its aftermath came the epoch-defining splitting off of Europe into West and East. It's hard to imagine where you could see all these colliding fractures in Europe more clearly than from here in Berlin. The Cold War gave an extra polemical punch and depth to the so-called Western, defined against communism and also fascism. It helped us to talk about a typically Western compromise between religion and the state. Our secularism light, our loose compromise with our so-called Judeo-Christian heritage, was regularly contrasted with Soviet atheism to the East. This may well be a key reason for the so-called return of religion, which means, among many other things, denaturalizing and becoming aware of our strange negotiations with religion. Arguably, we've become more self-conscious and traumatized about the relationship between Europe, America, and religion since we lost that convenient touchstone, the religionless East. The return of religion also means the resurgence of religion, and is bound up with the return of Islam or Islamicism, and that spectacular image of the outsider crashing into the Twin Towers as if the old gates of Vienna had moved west. America's 9/11 and its aftermath also turned America into a site of self-reflecting controversy and accusation, repeating what happened with Europe with the collapse of empire and the Holocaust. So Europe has not just been geographically changeable, for example, stretching east and southeast in the 19th century. Together with its geographically more stable partner, North America, it has constantly shuffled its identity and remade its specific virtues in relation to communism, fascism, empire, the post-colonial, Holocaust, Zion, Islam. Since the 1940s, we've all gradually become Judeo-Christian rather than simply Christian. The Judeo-Christian is a term that seems to go very carefully back behind the Christian towards the most ancient foundation. It's a shock therefore, to find that the term is barely antique in the official sense of being 100 years old. It first debuted in the 1880s and first entered public discourse in America in 1939. The term Judeo-Christian was strategically mobilized in opposition to pro-fascist leaders and anti-Semites gathering under the heading Christian. The hyphen was a sign of Christian repentance, Christian hospitality, solidarity. It named a new fraternity. It made Jews one of three fighting faiths of democracy. Protestantism and Catholicism were the other two. Grammatically, to hyphenate is to divide or connect, and the function of the Judeo-Christian has been to divide and to connect, to create alliances within a moderate and contained pluralism. And through that very demonstration of religious pluralism and moral virtue, to define the Judeo-Christian against the Cold War enemy. In the 1950s, Dwight Eisenhower, who added the phrase under God to the Pledge of Allegiance, publicly evoked the Judeo-Christian concept of all men created equal against the threefold public enemy, communism, Korea, and corruption. Almost all begin with C. Like all vocabularies of freedom, the Judeo-Christian was usefully flexible and free. In 1958, the economist Elgin Grossclothes, lovely name, could proclaim that ideas drawn from the Judeo-Christian scriptures have made possible the economic strength and industrial power of this country, while a Republican senator could proclaim that the communist projection of man as a producing, consuming animal to be used and discarded was antithetical to all the Judeo-Christian understandings, which are the foundations upon which the Republic stands. The Judeo-Christian conjures the illusion of cultural solidity and foundation while functioning as an empty space capable of accommodating a whole range of goods, including industrialism, capitalism, man as more than a productive animal, democracy, equality, a filing cabinet of values, collectively standing for value in a conveniently blurred economic and also moral sense. At the same time, Judeo-Christian implies an essence and conformity that could not be conjured in the same way by, say, secular Christian or Hindu Christian or Muslim Christian. Multiculturalism is gestured to and managed by taking a group whose differences are masked by proximity to the Christian, at least sharing the same Bible, more or less. The Judeo-Christian implies a structure of welcome dependent on embracing or being close to the fundamental values of the welcoming group. But now these days, Judeo-Christian seems conservative and a little out of date. We were Judeo-Christian. Now those of us who keep up with the times tend to be Abrahamic or Judeo-Christo-Islamic. In contrast to the more gently progressive and expansive term, the Abrahamic, the Judeo-Christian now feels like a relic from the Reagan era, or a fossilized term used by the religious right. The Abrahamic stands in gentle, hospitable contrast to the merely Judeo-Christian. Like the Judeo-Christian, it registers and answers an accusation, or two accusations. Accusations of our violence against the Islamic world, damaging our claims to virtues of multiculturalism and freedom, and accusations of an exclusive Judeo-Christian complicity around Israel. Gently, quietly, the Abrahamic acknowledges the Palestinians and Iraqis and all those other Abrahamic others. It's also been mobilized to tell the true children of Abraham what true religion should be in the peaceable, productive democracy economy to come. Tony Blair's Faith and Globalization Initiative, sponsored by the Yale Divinity School and the Yale School of Management, is all about, quote, bringing the faith closer together in the understanding of our common value and heritage, and teaching an updated version of the old compromise between the spirit of religion and the spirit of liberty as the free market economy. So the hostility between the spirit of religion and the global economy still evident in other places, and sometimes even in ours, can be overcome. Ingeniously, the Abrahamic gestures to difference and creates a composite religious identity around the monotheistic, the Father, the One. The fact that our public spokesman now regularly pledged commitment to the Abrahamic is a sign of good faith in freedom of religion. It's taken as another proof of freedom of religion and the virtue of democracy. But at the same time, it gently coerces and gathers in with the force of origin, an original identity or a stable essence that is fundamentally one and the same. Abraham is an ironic and iconic figure of hospitality, welcoming in Genesis 18 the three figures who could be taken as God, the Trinity, or simply fellow human beings, brothers, believers. Abraham can be easily converted to Judaism, Christianity, or Islam. The old name Abraham is domestic, recognisable, and a little vaguely, manageably, modestly foreign. It implies friendship with brothers in Palestine, Iraq, Egypt, all those Arabic Semitic places of the Middle East. Without doing anything other than imply that all these regimes and citizens are equally vaguely religious, and without giving any clue as to what talk of the Abrahamic might mean in the context of Israel-Palestine, revolution and counter-revolution in Egypt, or the Arab Spring. Like the Lockean Bible, the old Erman watches over us as a benign foundation, a positive symbol with nothing direct or specific to add to the conversation of government, law, or economy. We can talk pie-eyed about the Abrahamic, while the real work goes on at the level of economy, oil prices, or complex discourses on strategy in the idioms of international relations. Perhaps this is the point of the Abrahamic. It's a nice phrase, but something from the old archives of the religious, the retired, emeritus past of the Bible, and relatedly, fraternally, but also deeply controversially for Euro-America, the Quran. The Abrahamic bespeaks good intentions without content. It's strangely empty, even vacuous. A perfect meeting place because nothing essential takes place there. The appeal of Abraham is that he is the Ur-man, the Ur-punkt and the Treff-punkt, but not central. In a place before the centre, he's not Christ, Moses, Torah, Muhammad or the Quran. Thus Abraham is everything and nothing. He's the no religion's land that is every religion's land, or at least the three Abrahamic religions' land. Islam, Judaism and Christianity can gather as brothers under one father, under the capacious tent of Abraham, and do so all the more easily because this father is not the centre of any of the three religions he seems to found. The name of Abraham holds out the promise of a dim and distant background, a desert which has not yet been built on, without us any green lines or separation barriers or apartheid walls. He's the place where we can all get together before the difference starts. As the inaugurator of a generalised and universalisable monotheism or ethical monotheism, he's pre-Mosaic before the law, before all the specifics of the law and Sharia or Halakha. He represents the vague beginning that can be understood as the beginning of everyone and everything. As the Ur-believer, content and specific, this is what St. Paul makes him, he offers a welcome to all comers, provided that they sign up to the basic covenant of ethical monotheism, and provided they leave all controversial differences at the door. I want to upset this bland and banal public story of the Abrahamic by looking into the strange old archives of the Judeo-Christian scriptures. These are texts largely lost to us in ways that no other texts are lost to us. The Bible is massively present as foundation and icon. But as text, full of prickly, difficult detail, it has been removed from the public arena and outsourced to specialists, those biblical scholars in the modern research university, as first modelled here in Berlin. Traditional biblical scholarship has functioned as a massive disciplinary machine for separating the Bible as a historical document from politics and philosophy. By relentlessly and rigorously historicising, it reinforces the Bible's emeritus status and places these texts in a museum of the Hellenistic world or the ancient Near East. This rigorous historicization of the Bible was designed explicitly to head off religious extremism and enforce the alliance between the spirit of religion and the spirit of liberty. Biblical studies thrives on and multiplies difficulty, but at the same time it controls difficulty by making the only relevant difficulties those of source, kfela. Difficulty is disciplined, but once difficulty is confined and disciplined as a matter of source, the hypotheses and ertex can run wild. To take a slight detour away from Abraham towards a certain Moses, recall that Freud's notoriously Egyptian, notoriously murdered Moses was inspired by the biblical scholar and archaeologist Ernst Sellin, who taught in Vienna and also here in Berlin, and who found hidden clues, very hidden, to the martyrdom of Moses in the book of Hosea, which incidentally also showed that Moses was the Messiah. Writing before and after the Anschluss, and taking his Moses on another exodus from Vienna to London, Freud combined Selin's revelation of the slaying of Moses with what he felt as an equally and perhaps even more profound shock. He doubly displaced the origin and secret of monotheism. The origin and secret of monotheism was trauma, repression, and also foreignness. Moses was, in truth, an Egyptian. The commonplace that Moses was an Egyptian name and that Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, so says the New Testament book of Acts, was turned by Freud into a far stronger, indeed monstrous, denouement of alien nationality. The stimulus for monotheism came from outside, from a great stranger. The shock and difficulty far exceeds anything that source criticism can do to origins. The origin of monotheism has now shifted outside Judaism, outside Europe, east of Europe, to the wrong part of the so-called Middle East, Egyptian, Arabic, not biblical, not that part of the Semitic, seen as an intimate relation and predecessor for the European. Freud seems obsessed with anachronistically relating the Bible to the modern nation state. He projects back onto ancient and non-Western societies the modern Western bias of rigidly and geometrically defined territorial property, and writes as if Egypt were already an independent state, as it became awkwardly and unevenly in 1922. Moses is Egyptian, not Hebrew. He's from Egypt, not Israel. But at the same time, he creates strange displaced cartographies of Europe, mapped as turbulent as mental spaces, in which people, especially Jewish people, or, as he puts it, Neo-Egyptian Semites, are hard to place in time and space. Europe's Jews are seen as foreign, secondary, even though they came to cities like Cologne with the Romans long before the Germanic tribes, he says. They are different from their hosts, but not fundamentally so, since they're not a foreign Asiatic race, but mostly consist of the remnants of Mediterranean peoples, and yet they are different, especially from the Nordic peoples, although sometimes it's hard to define in what respects. The Jewish identity graphically unhinges the very notion of identity as recognisable characteristics or persistence in time, or the quality or condition of being the same as something else. In a dramatic psychopolitics, Freud presents what he calls an unaccustomed topographical conception of the mental apparatus, in which the mental life is, quote, an apparatus consisting of several hierarchies, districts, and provinces. The state of mind is literally a state of mind in the other sense. At the centre, which is also the margins, lies the repressed, the isolated and unconscious material, which is like, he says, a state within the state, useless for the common weal. In this strange psychopolitics, the id, or the s, is like those hidden secret parts that do nothing with and for the state, those old residues and recalcitrants and fanatics, those outwith the bonds of humane society, believed to owe primary allegiance to another place, another sovereign, another homeland, another prince. The potentially seditious state within the state, das S, was translated as the id in English. And not without reason did James Strachey worry that the id would suggest the yid. I love the cover of this. This is Edward Said's Freud and Non-European, and I love the image of the kind of the Rorschach test, the way in which the Europe appears as a kind of doubled spectre, a sort of eerie grey ghost. Though he simplifies the meaning of Freud's mental and European topographies, Edward Said rightly recognises Freud as an overturner and remapper of accepted or settled geographies and genealogies. Like Freud's Moses, Said's lecture was unexpectedly split between Vienna and London. The lecture, originally scheduled to be given at the Freud Institute in Vienna in 2001, was suddenly cancelled because Said had been photographed without his knowledge, throwing a stone during a visit to South Lebanon to see the recently evacuated security zone recaptured by the Lebanese. Said joined those who threw what he called stones of celebration across the border into an empty space. And the little pebble took on massive topspin, helped by Israeli propaganda, which turned him into a rock-throwing terrorist. The cancellation of the lecture and the attempt by the director of the Viennese Freud Institute to claim that this was to protect Vienna's Jews, already under threat from the right-wing alliance between Jörg Haider's Freedom Party and Wolfgang Schlüssel's People's Party, adds an extra level of irony to Said's attempt to reread Freud's Moses in the light of the aftermath of the Second World War. Suddenly, writes Said, the world of Moses and monotheism has come alive in this tiny sliver of land in the Eastern Mediterranean, in the real conflict between what he calls the Jewish European and the non-Europeans, embodied in the indigenous Arabs of Palestine, Egyptians, Lebanese, Syrians, and Jordanians. And now Freud is being read by real Arabs, real Palestinians like Said. Said's division between the Arabs and Arabs of Palestine and the Jewish Europeans was out of date, even 12 years ago. Israel and Israel's politics and political class is now more than ever before a little black, Mizrahi, Eastern, and defined by a civil rebellion against the Labour Party of the white Europeans. Said argues that contemporary Israeli legislation countervenes, represses, and even cancels what he diagnoses as Freud's carefully maintained opening out of Jewish identity towards its non-Jewish background. Thus, Israeli policy resists the inevitability which Freud, in a sense, prophesied of a bi-national state. Said sought to use his lecture to evangelise about Freud's anti-provincialism and preach a timely lesson to a provincialised Europe and exclusivist Zion that builds apartheid walls and seals off identity from all outsides. Said is simplifying the states and states of mind in Freud's Moses and also Israeli-Palestinian politics. Or perhaps more charitably, he's purifying and streamlining for the sake of parable and prophecy. Freud becomes a prophet who sees before and against his time the very timely contemporary lesson that identity cannot be thought or worked through itself alone. It cannot constitute or even imagine itself without that radical originary break or flaw which will not be repressed. Said concedes that in Freud, the non-European is still orientalised, ghostly, and that the actuality of the non-European only goes so far as its constitutive presence as a sort of fissure in the figure of Moses. But this orientalization of the Egyptian does not detract from the lesson that, quote, In excavating the archaeology of Jewish identity, Freud insisted that it did not begin with itself, but rather with other identities, Egyptian and Arabian. For different reasons and in different tones, both Yosef Yerushalmi and Jan Assmann want to tell Freud that sin and guilt and foreignness are not deeply buried secrets to be excavated by the analyst archaeologist. The Bible seems perversely determined to carry the dark and dark-skinned truths of Egyptianness and guilt on the surface of the text. Freud, too, already knows this. Though he doesn't apply it to his Egyptian murdered Moses, he's also aware of this strange biblical tendency to conserve everything, over and above and against the interests of the Bible and its people and its gods. Thinking particularly of the violence of the god Yahweh and the guilty record of the invasion of Canaan, Freud writes, "It's truly astonishing that in spite of all the revisions in the biblical text, so much was allowed to stand." This point can be pushed much further than Freud, Assmann or Yerushalmi takes it. By opening up for general circulation the secrets usually guarded by biblical scholars. Biblical scholars alone know about the tormented and divided origins in Genesis and the strange surrogate families around the biblical Abrahamic, which is far less bland than the official Abrahamic of contemporary PR. But the secrets are safe with them because they're trained to put them to work in the work of source criticism, making the division of origin a purely technical, professional point. What would happen if we were to put these secret truths on general release and allow them to mix with nationhood, politics, religion and representation and identity? What would it mean to read Genesis and the Abrahamic as if the consequences extended beyond the insular politics of scholarly dynasties towards the inheritances that define our politics and spaces here in Europe, Euro-America and its outsides? And here's a little Bible study bit. So the book of Genesis is not beholden to conventions of modern history. And the authors had complete freedom in retrojecting the myth history of Israel. Why then did they not indulge in the luxury and purity of an autochthonous story? Why didn't they present their ancestors as indigenous, aborigine, there from the Genesis? In their partisan book, why did they not allow themselves the luxury of the myth of the empty land? On the contrary, as soon as the land is given in the promise to Abraham, God adds the embarrassed addendum or caveat that the land is currently full of Canaanites, who then break down into a myriad swarm of Kenites, Kenizzites, Kadmonites, Hittites, Perizzites, Amorites, Canaanites, Girgashites, and Jebusites, not to mention the Rephaim or giants. You can't see all the names, but you can see the sense of crowding on this map. The Spanish Orientalist and editor of the Antwerp Polyglot, Benito Montano, got the cluttered demographics just right in his pedantically literalist map, The Land of Canaan in the Time of Abraham. Far from an ancient desert utopia, Canaan is presented as crowded as London or Manhattan. Faithful to the biblical record, Montano crams the land with no less than 31 kingdoms and tribes. Hilariously, in the interest of credulity, Montano, whose name was derived from his birthplace in the mountainous regions of Fregenal de la Sierra, hypothesized that the land was extremely mountainous as a way of increasing the surface area and explaining how so many people could fit on such a small space of land. The extremely hard to obtain land of Canaan is promised again and again and again. And almost every time, in fact in total 27 times, with disarming and disturbing honesty, the promise is accompanied with an inventory of all the current peoples already in the land. The surface of the narrative betrays the truth that they were never eradicated, that Israel was never purely itself. Biblical Canaan, as faithfully represented by Montano, reminds us how far the biblical land is, and always has been, from the rigidly and geometrically defined territorial property of the modern nation-state. Land given by God is, it seems, not as clear and stable as land recognised in international law. It's far more crowded and complex than a merely binational state. And if possession is 9/10 of the law, as we say in English, we should add that though the land is given, it's hardly ever and only temporarily possessed. Insecure possession in space, alongside those myriad others, is paralleled by insecure, temporary possession in time. Abraham receives the promise of the land, enters the land, then immediately exits it due to famine, which drives him towards Egypt. Egypt is far from foreign in the Bible. As a constant intertext, a place of enmity, danger, nurture, and refuge, it's a site of admiration, distrust, envy, and emulation, often at the same time. Egypt is a home from home, and not just for Moses. Take, for example, the story of Joseph at the end of Genesis. Taken to Egypt by the Ishmaelites, sons of Hagar the Egyptian, by Abraham, Joseph practices divination, he takes an Egyptian theophoric name, he marries an Egyptian woman, and he becomes the son-in-law of an Egyptian priest. Back to Abraham. As aliens and strangers in Egypt, Abraham and Sarah go through the first of what scholars rather quaintly term the ancestress in danger stories. Fearful for his life, lest the Egyptians kill him for the sake of Sarah's beauty, Abraham passes off his wife as his sister. Sarah is taken into Pharaoh's house, and Abraham is given sheep, oxen, donkeys, camels, and male and female slaves in return. Return for what? The text is obviously very anxious about the paternity of Israel, introducing at the very beginning the possibility that Israel may be Egyptian at its origin. Freud would love this if the memory were not so transparent, so easy to read. The story dramatises an anxiety of paternity that will then be anxiously repeated as an anxiety of maternity. When Abraham actually has sex with Hagar, the Egyptian slave, because Sarah is unable to conceive. The puzzle of Genesis is not just that there are so many others, but that some of them are so close to us and prior to us, so intimate with us, and discussed at such elaborate length. Why does Genesis seem so attached to a ritualistically repeated template of an origin divided between firstborn and secondborn? Why is the eponymous ancestor of Israel always haunted by a shadow side, a twin, an other brother who is there before him, or a surrogate family lurking just outside the tent? For Isaac, there is Ishmael and also Hagar. For Jacob, Esau. In both cases, Ishmael and Esau are the firstborn. Why this strange kamikaze desire to present our ancestor as the one who had to wrest the blessing from the firstborn or expel the other family into the desert to make enough room for us? And why keep this act of dispossession on record? To put it crudely, if you want to write a people out, you can do it quite easily through an act of deselection, texticide, a form of elimination that's relatively painless. This would all be part of a normal day's work for Hebrew narrative. After all, Hebrew narrative is famously terse. It uses words as if they're on ration. It's always deselecting detail, not just detail that we would consider superfluous, but detail that we would rather prefer to have kept in. Goddesses, daughters, mothers, details are regularly catapulted off the edge of the page. This origin story is resolutely androcentric. So why not resolutely Israelite or Judean? Why not use the origin as a self-bolstering fantasy space? In Nietzsche Genealogy History, Foucault discusses how the traditional quest for the origin is shaped by the desire to extract the exact essence of things and carefully protected identities freed from accident and succession. To this, he contrasts his own, also Nietzschean, practice of genealogy. Genealogy is concerned with dispersed events of heterogenesis, invasions, strugglings, plunderings, disguises, ploys. It exposes the secret that things have no essence, or that their essence was fabricated in a piecemeal fashion from alien forms. Genesis reads like a work of heterogenesis, or a genealogy in the Foucauldian sense. The essence is bound to alien forms. To adapt Said on Freud's Moses, the Genesis of Israel insists that it did not begin with itself, but rather with other identities, Egyptian and Arabian. And literally Egyptian and Arabian in the story of Hagar, the first Egyptian wife of Abraham, who was driven out to Egypt, having given Abraham his first son. If we take these stories seriously, then we end up with a Hagaramic that precedes and haunts the Abrahamic before the Abrahamic starts. We need the Hagaramic for the Abrahamic to start. Abraham, you will remember if you've read your Bibles recently, has been promised a son. And then comes the long wait, the impossibility. Obtaining a son is even more drawn out and difficult than obtaining the land. The land is immensely, intensely crowded, and Sarah is old, post-menopause. When she's told that she's going to have a son, she laughs. God withholds the son. Until Abraham has a son, he cannot be the founding father, and nothing can start. Sarah, impatient before the implausible, gives Hagar, her slave, Sarah's slave, that is the first Saracen, to Abraham. And Abraham has sex with Sarah, with Hagar rather, so even I'm getting them mixed up, and she becomes pregnant. Only much later does Sarah give birth to Isaac when God visits her. Sarah is like Mary here, and she conceives. Sarah expels Hagar twice, once when she's pregnant in Genesis 16, and once in Genesis 21, where she sees Ishmael yitzhaking, which means to play, but also to Isaac, to play Isaac. She expels Ishmael so that Isaac alone will inherit. The second time Ishmael goes off, he leaves for good. Half Hebrew, or half Abrahamic and half Egyptian, half Arab, he goes off in the direction of Egypt, geographically west and south of Israel, but conceptually for us, east. Now, admittedly, it might be a little tricky to write origin as essence, propriety, purity, virginity, and sole possession. But Genesis doesn't just flounder on the difficulty. It insists on the point and goes to the opposite extreme. The origin does not and cannot happen without the essential supplement or surrogate. How strange to have a story in which the origin cannot take place without Hagar, the stranger, with the mistress needing, supplicating, surrogate life from the body of the slave. Surely it would have been possible for the absolute God of monotheism to offer the gift of a single origin within a united family, in short, the perfect gift. But instead, in narrative and biological or genetic terms, the text insists on the fact that Israel is derivative, a representation of a truth or a birth that has already taken place. Moreover, the displacement is remembered, and is remembered with guilt. The expulsion of Hagar the Egyptian is told as an inverted exodus. The narrative seems to be deliberately stealing from the exodus, but switching the places of victim and victimized. Oppressed in the Israelite house of bondage, the slave boasts flees and is forced out, just like the Israelites in the Exodus. She leaves the house of Abraham and ends up at Shur on the borders of Egypt. She departs carrying bread on her shoulders like the manna in the desert, and she enters the wilderness. She finds water in the desert and is found by a messenger or angel of God when she's about to die. In the Islamic story of Hagar's expulsion, the site where she finds the water becomes the foundation of the holy city of Mecca. Through Ishmael, she becomes an ancestress of the prophet. Her name, pronounced in Arabic with a soft G, Hajar, is one of the centres of the Hajj, and her quest for water is remembered in the rituals of the Hajj. But Hagar is not mentioned by name in the Quran. The Bible, to its own destruction, is more expansive on Hagar than the Quran. In Genesis, Hagar, Hagar, is the first to bear a son and the first to receive a divine visitation, two full chapters before Abraham welcomes the three divine guests. Even more strangely, she becomes a quasi-patriarch, receiving a direct repetition of the Abrahamic promise, "I will so greatly multiply your offspring that they cannot be counted for multitude," uttered just a chapter previously, for all the world, as if it were going to be unique. It's as if Hagar takes over a domestic narrative that never gets to be properly domesticated, because the foreign Egyptian slave always does things that only patriarchs get to do and first. And I've just noticed the time, so I'm going to cut the last section, you'll be delighted to know, and sort of end with a question, which is really kind of my key question, which is, what would it mean if we were to put these secret truths on general release, and if we were allowed them to mix with nationhood, politics, religion, and representation and identity? So what if we took these kind of divided, troubled, shadow origins and allowed them to play beyond the sphere of the kind of specialists who kind of guard the secrets of the biblical text? We can look at the text in a little bit more detail in the close reading tomorrow. Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Yvonne. Thank you also for thinking of time.